Today, we're going to talk about recommendations for implementing and teaching about diversity. Again, the theme of today's academic symposium is using evidence to improve teaching and learning in higher education. And we have three groups of panelists today who are going to talk about their research. First, we have Gabrielle Marzani-Nissen, Michael Moxley, and Marcella Willis, who will introduce and talk about their research, Shifting Paradigms, Implementing the Sullivan Commission for Diversity in the Healthcare Workforce, Recommendations to Increase Student Diversity at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. Then we're going to have Andy Anderson, Bob Covert, Pamela Lobb, and Sandra Lopez-Baez, Effective Multicultural Education. And last, but certainly not least, Professor Patrice Grimes, who will present the Curry School of Education Self-Study on Diversity Teaching and Learning. The format, we're going to have group one, group two, and group three present for about 13 to 15 minutes each, and then we're going to have about 30 to 35 minutes for question and answer. So use those noggins and jot down questions to ask the presenters at the end. And I'm going to introduce the first group, or the first group can come up if they're going to use their PowerPoint presentation.
Can everybody hear me well enough? All right. I would like to welcome you to this presentation, and I very much appreciate the ability to be able to bring these findings to you and to discuss our project this morning. The title is Shifting Paradigms, Implementing Sullivan Commission Recommendations to Increase Diversity at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. I'd like to first start out by saying that this project is the result of a commitment from many people, as well as from the institution of the University of Virginia, specifically the Dean's Office and the School of Medicine Office of Admissions. I think we need to give particular props to a lot of the Dean's Office membership, Dr. Dukoski, Dr. Hostler, Provost Garson, and Dr. Canterbury, Dr. Oliver, and Wendy Elamin, all of whom this would not be possible to present, especially in our admissions office, Leslie Thomas, who's also working with the Dean's Office, has been instrumental in getting this project off the ground and providing me the opportunity to share, us the opportunity to share these findings with you today. So why is this important? Let's talk a little bit about the background here. I think everyone can agree that access to healthcare for minorities is not equal. The landmark study on equal treatment from the Institute of Medicine supports this. It has documented very well that there's lower quality of healthcare and higher rates of illness, disability, and premature deaths in the minority population. Minority physicians are also more likely to serve underrepresented populations and underserved populations, and there's a significant amount of data that supports this as well. So the Sullivan Commission was established in 2004 to look at the diversity and how the healthcare workforce is the supply for healthcare workers for in this area of increased diversity in the American population. It was established to make policy recommendations to address this scarcity of minorities in the health professions. Through a series of investigations and discussions in travel nationwide, the commission came up with 37 recommendations and three basic principles. And let's just talk a little bit about some of their findings. They obviously noticed that there was a diversity gap in African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, who make up about 25% of the U.S. population. However, they only account for 9% of the nurses, 6% of the physicians, 5% of the dentists in the country. Similarly, the faculty representation is almost the same. 10% of nursing faculty is underrepresented in medicine. 4.2% of medical school faculty are minorities. and 8% of faculty in dental schools are made up minorities. So again, the Sullivan Commission came up with 37 recommendations and three principles. And the basic three principles were, in order to increase the diversity in healthcare professions, the culture of health professions must change. Also, we have to find new and non-traditional paths to healthcare positions in healthcare professions. That should be explored. The third recommendation, the third principle, said that this commitment must come from the governmental level as well as from the private sector.
So I thought I would talk about it from the perspective of the Office of Admissions, speaking as one of the assistant deans here in the Office of Admissions. And please excuse my tweaked neck. So in 2004, the dean and senior leadership for the School of Medicine, committed to diversity, envisioned a process by which students traditionally underrepresented in medicine could be more formally represented in the medical school class. And Dr. Randy Canterbury embraced this mission that was outlined by both Provost Garson and Sharon Hosler, Dr. Hosler at the time, and formalized a process of both outreach and recruitment through the Office of Admissions in the School of Medicine, as well as in the Office for Diversity. And so what happened is we had a cultural shift which took place. And it included the increased membership of students and faculty who were underrepresented in medicine in the admissions process, as well as implementation of a day-long retreat for all admissions members. And this retreat included a focus on holistic approaches to student applications. So just really thinking about people in a very, you know, sort of a complete holistic way, rather than just by GPA and MCAT scores, thinking about what people brought to the table in terms of life experiences, passions, and so forth and so on. And we also wanted to make sure that within that presentation and diversity, that both that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues were attended to, because this is a population that has traditionally been underrepresented in medicine as well, kind of a hidden population. Contemporaneously, what we did is we had both a proactive admissions office and an assistant dean for medical education, who was Wendy Alamine, who you may or may not know, as well as the Office of Diversity, working sort of simultaneously to create pipelines and mentoring and initiating things within the greater university as well as the community. So, for example, reaching out to the high schools in the community, reaching out to a variety of organizations, which we'll talk about in a moment. And in addition, Dr. Alamine really was aggressive in active recruitment of historically black colleges at pre-medical conferences, and as well as really working closely with the Daniel Hale Williams Society, the Student National Medical Association, and the National Network of Latin American Medical Students during these recruitment activities. And students in other organizations, such as the LGBT community, became very active both in the outreach and in on the admissions committee. And Marcella is going to talk a little bit more about that in a little bit.
So we're going to outline the efforts made by the UVA institution to address the gap in diversity. Also going to relate the outcomes associated with the increasing diversity in the student body at University of Virginia School of Medicine, and specifically looking at USMLE pass rates and average scores. So in the time period from 2003 to 2010, the percentage of students underrepresented in medicine who matriculated in UVA more than tripled from 5.7% to 21%. Underrepresented in medicine includes African American, Hispanic, Native American, and Alaskan Hawaiian American. So using data from the UVA School of Medicine, we determined these percentages from that 2003-2010 time frame. We also looked at the U.S. medical licensing exams, step one and step two scores for these classes. And what we found was that the average USMLE step one and step two scores either increased or remained stable over this time frame. And the pass rates for the exams remain stable. It also should be worth mentioning that the national pass rates for these exams were somewhat lower than what the pass rates were for here at UVA and the averages. So what we have done is we've established that we can increase diversity in the medical school. We've accomplished it in the face of stagnant national percentages of applicants and matriculants underrepresented in medicine. This just shows you the data overall. Again, from the years 2003 to 2010, the entering class percentage of underrepresented in medicine at UVA. And then the second column is the second row is the percent underrepresented in medicine nationally, which is, again, sort of remained stagnant in the 15 to 16% range. Then we have the step one U.S. medical licensing exam average, and then the pass rate is put in parentheses. Step two average and pass rate also in parentheses for the upcoming years. And again, as you can see, those pass rates and averages have either increased or remained stable over that time with the increase in diversity in our classes. This table shows the makeup of the different underrepresented in medicine applicants, as well as matriculants into the university, into the national medical school classes. Again, as you can see, if you look at the bottom line, the percentages are pretty stagnant around the 15 to 16% range, and that's been going on since 2003. So that underlies the underscores the challenge that we have as medical school faculty and as medical school admissions officers, where the pool remains the same, but we're trying to increase the amount of diversity. So that is a particular challenge that we really do need to address.
And just to let you know, Dr. Moxley also has some of the latest numbers for the step one, step two pass rates, which I suspect if you ask him about, he would be delighted to share with you during the question and answer period. So a couple of examples of specific strategies that we used included, as I mentioned, changing the admissions committee itself. Traditionally, what happened is we had members on the admissions committee who did not have any term limits. They would just come on, they would stay for years. It was a very static process. People would kind of quietly move off, and then people would come on. But what we decided to do is to actually formalize term limits. So now what we do is we actually have 3-year term limits for all members. So 1/3 of the admissions committee turns over every year. And what that allows us to do is to have a little institutional memory in the admissions committee, but also allows us to have some sort of fresh faces, fresh thoughts, and so forth and so on. Within the 27 members, we actually have 10 medical students who come on every year. And these are fourth-year medical students who are interviewed and selected through a lottery process, which allows us to have some nice representation that way. But we also make sure to have nice medical and surgical representation, people interested in primary care, some specialty care, and so really a broad swath of diversity in all its forms. I also do want to mention that in the medical school class, 1/3 of our class historically actually come from the humanities and social sciences, and 50% of our class have been out for 1 year or longer. We have studio art majors, we have astronomy majors, we have people in biomedical engineering, we have former lawyers, and I'm going to continue going very quickly now. So what we did is, in terms of the focus on the role of diversity, is that Dr. El Amin was specifically recruited to develop and implement certain programs, and working closely with Dr. Canterbury, she accomplished the following. So basically, Marcy was going to tell you just a little bit about the Daniel Hell Williams. Maybe we can do it during the question and answer period because we're running low on time. But what she did is she created a toolkit for success. She presented it at the UVA Summer Medical and Dental Association program, lots of community service opportunities for minority undergraduate service. She was a mentor for the UVA Summer Medical and Dental Education, presented at Hampton, secured research summer position, presented at Second Look, and did a variety of other things. And Marcy, as a fourth-year medical student, I was going to have her just talk a little bit about that experience from her perspective.
Okay, so some of the keys to the success of the University of Virginia School of Medicine. So really a warm environment with approachable people, and this is especially true for the Office of Admissions. Speaking personally, when I interviewed, they were so welcoming and warm, and it immediately made me feel comfortable. And that was kind of my first impression of UVA School of Medicine, and really made me comfortable in my decision to come here. The importance of human connection and nurturing, accessibility to accomplished mentors, and this happens during the first and second years of medical school, not just the third and fourth. And it's really easy to email any attendings if you want to do research or shadow them. Visibility of mentors representing diverse backgrounds, creation of and establishment of pipelines in high schools and colleges, especially the medical science clubs, which the SNMA helps run in local Charlottesville high schools. Active recruitment in health fairs and student fairs, close connections with the SNMA, which is a major part of recruiting for underrepresented minorities, the Daniel Hell Williams Society, which is the undergrad pre-med society made up of underrepresented minorities and LGBT communities, holistic review of applications, diversity on admissions committee, term limits on admissions committee membership, strong and unyielding support from administration, and as well as yearly training on diversity and cross-cultural sensitivity and training. And all of these keys have played a huge role in making UVA a more diverse school and also improving the school as a whole.
The first group in the effective multicultural education is
looking out. So my name is Bob Covert. And I always start my class by asking the students to think, what do you think about me? But we don't really have trouble. We don't have time for that right now. So in terms of, you know, the idea of evidence in terms of changing instruction, that's what our panel is about. So I'm just going to give like a two-minute overview of what the class is about and then turn it over to my colleagues. The class usually has about 100-plus students, very diverse group of people, about 50 to 60% people of color. And the purpose, the intent of the class is to develop cultural competence, which basically starts out with becoming aware of your own prejudices, becoming aware of systemic prejudice and discrimination and how it operates in our society, and then basically, how do you do something about it? So we include a community service component. The topics that we generally deal with throughout the semester are racial issues, sexual orientation issues, gender and sex, classism, socioeconomic status, and ableism. And one of the differences about the class is that we really try to do these things experientially. And so it's not about reading and taking tests, it's about how those different things affect the people right in the classroom. And so that's a general overview of what we do, and I'll turn it over to the people who actually did some research to see if it works or not.
All right, so what you're going to hear is two different studies that are on EDLF 5000, which is Dr. Bob's class. And the first one I did, it was on multicultural self-awareness. And I basically had two questions that I wanted to look at. One was, how did the students' self-awareness about multicultural topics change throughout the semester? And then two, which instructional strategies that we used did they think supported that growth? So this is the little paradigm I was working from. The course is loosely based on Banks' social action approach, which asks students, what does this mean to you? They get content, they get information, but it's interactive, and it's all about what does it mean to them personally, and what can they do about it? So I used Bennett's developmental model of intercultural sensitivity, and I looked at student reflection papers, topic papers, and interview transcripts to see if the class really was effective at changing their self-awareness. And this is Bennett's continuum. The light green stages are ethnocentric, and that's where the student sees their own culture as the only real and valid culture. And the dark green stages are ethno-relative, where they realize that all cultures are equally valid. And so this was what I used. These were the results for the six students that I followed. They all showed an increase in self-awareness of the multicultural topics. But since we're educators, I think this slide is a little bit more helpful. These are the instructional strategies, some of them that we use that I asked the students about. And the number one instructional strategies that they said supported their learning was small group discussion. These are small groups of 10 or 12 students that meet every week and discuss the topic. The next was the interactive large group activity, and they are always interactive. And the third one, which really surprised me, was the meet and greet. At the beginning of every class, the students are asked to find someone different from them and discuss a topic, 5 or 6 minutes. And 4 of the 6 students said that this instructional strategy really supported their learning. And this is an instructional strategy that's quick, it's easy, 5 or 6 minutes at the beginning of class, talking to someone who's different from you. So that provides opportunities for more interaction. So what does it mean for UVA or other institutions? 1, provide those opportunities for students to interact with people who are different from them. 2, focus on what students can do personally. It's good to have content and information, and I'm going to actually do a talk Monday on things you need to know about American Indians for a group. But what they really need to know is, what does it mean to them personally? So focus on that, and I think those are probably the 2 really big things that I got from the study. So, maya tiki oasen. Thank you. Sandy.
Well, Andy gets
a doctoral degree too.
Oh yeah, really. Thank you for that one.
While Andy gets there, I'm just going to briefly say that our research, we have been trying to design an instrument to capture outcomes, and Bob was generous enough to allow us to use our instrument in his class to tap the students, and the students would tell us how much personal growth they perceived they attained through that class, as opposed to other activities that they do academically.
My turn?
Go.
Good morning. So Sandy and I represent 1 of 2 studies that come together. The intersection is the participants in the class that Bob and Pam taught. Pam has just described her dissertation study, which is sort of like looking at a few students in the class, their outcomes, with a microscope. We took the view that we're going to back away and look at the whole class with binoculars, a little more traditional empirical study. We're interested in the construct of personal growth, defined loosely as positive psychological changes that occur during a time period of interest to the researcher. It's related but different from the construct of multicultural self-awareness. The intervention, the thing that we were most interested in attributions of growth to, were the academic experiences related to the course that Bob has just described. Our measure is borrowed from the literature. It's a 21-item instrument developed to measure, believe it or not, positive personal psychological changes after really big trauma. There's a small study of some Israeli people that spent time behind the barbed wire at Auschwitz in the group of comparison studies. Now, hopefully y'all's course is not like spending time behind bars, but the same kinds of changes that the folks who'd experienced trauma described, turns out we hear it all the time in counseling, personal narratives. You can read autobiographies and pick up the same thing. The 21-item instruments are, the instrument developers organized them into 5 subscales. I put the titles up there so you can read the subscale names and get a sense of the existential nature of the instrument. This is not academic cognitive information that we're going after.
So that's the subscales of the instrument. We wanted to do, we wanted to get a measure of the student's personal growth in these kinds of domains over the course of the semester, their total growth from everything, gains and losses in personal life, tragedies and triumphs, boredom, they got a new puppy, they inherited $1 million, they lost $1 million, all of that together. We figure growth comes from experiences. And then, if we could figure out a way to do that, we simply could ask them, how much of that do you attribute to your academic experiences? And how much do you attribute to EDLF, am I getting the right, EDLF 5000 in particular? And we did that in percentages. Let me show you enough of the instrument to where you can get a sense of how this might be possible and practical. Here's some sample items.
Back.
Whoa,
back.
One too far. Here's a sample of what Sandy's going to talk about. Here's some sample. All right, one more time.
It doesn't like that one, Andy.
What? It doesn't.
Like that one.
No. Stay, boy.
That's it.
All right. So again, we're measuring personal growth. It's a personality variable assessment, the standard kind of response scale that the instrument developers used, a Likert response scale of 6 positions, varying from no growth to very great growth. No rocket science there. Here's some example items, each from a different subscale. You could even take this. The thing is set up as an exercise, so if we had another 3 or 4 minutes, you could answer the questions based on your own personal growth this semester, get a rough cumulative, and compare your score to the comparison groups that we've got. I don't have time for that, and Sandy's going to walk you through the numbers. How'd I do? Is that what, more than 2.5 minutes?
Perfect.
All right.
I'll take half a minute.
I'll take this.
Hi. We have used that instrument now in measuring in several courses, including some of my own, some of Andy's. So we're looking at students reporting their perceived growth as an outcome of a course. So we're limiting it to one semester, although I've used it throughout my whole curriculum in mental counselors. So asking them, because some of our courses require the student to evolve as a person, how did you feel this course facilitated or not the evolution? So in applying that instrument to the multicultural class, we have some comparison groups. And the first group, like Andy said, is 13 trauma studies. The reason why we picked the instrument is because the authors of the instrument say that it's not just growth out of trauma, it's simple growth. They applied it to trauma the first time around, but now it's yielding results for people who are healthy and go through any kind of new learning experience. We have done 3 groups using UVA students, mostly undergraduates, and they have stated that 59. Are those percentiles?
No, this is the mean of the student scores. Here's the range of the trauma means, and here's our undergraduate means.
People in trauma have reported 40 to 80 units of growth at UVA for one particular course, 59, 60, and 63. So they're well within the range of saying, this course helped me grow. Basically, why are we doing that? We're doing that because we know that education gives the person more than just knowledge. And we're trying to capture the outcome of the experience of going through a course, a semester, a year, even the whole undergraduate curriculum, trying to figure out, did this change you as a person in these domains? So the multicultural education class, 34.97% of the growth was attributed to the class that semester. So the course does impact them at a personal level. When compared to other academic experiences, 23%. So total academic experiences, 58%. So they do learn, and the knowledge that they have alters them. But there's also a lot of other things that help them grow.
Sandy, it's probably worth me interrupting, because
sure,
I can't stand it not to. This means that Bob and Pam's course, the students said, 58% of our growth this semester was due to academic experiences, but well over half of that, 34 of the 58, was due to this one course, which was, of course, designed to facilitate this very kind of experience.
So what we're saying in our research is that courses that are designed to help the student grow and change whether it's to encountering information, knowledge, or other people, have a growthful outcome. So far, that's what we were trying to capture. And I'm going to stop here in case Bob wants to say something for a minute or two.
Nope.
And anything else?
So, Reggie, I wasn't even looking at the signs. How close did we come to running over?
Not close.
Not close? That means we didn't run over.
No.
Good.
You were on time.
All right. Oh. Good job.
We tried.
Good job, guys.
Can I just ask what the percentages in parentheses were?
Those are standard deviations. The mean was 58. The standard deviation, I don't know, 16%, something like that, plus or minus 16%.
Last we have Professor Grimes, who's going to talk about the Curry self-study.
They say that sometimes being last can be hardest because of all the people who come before you. But whoever designed the program, I'm very glad that I did, because each one of these presentations is building on what I'm about to talk about now. Our first presentation specifically talked about the recruitment of students and why that's so important. Then the next folks talked about when we get the students in class, then what do we do and how we teach them. But all of that presumes that you have a climate and environment and faculty who are trained professionally to be able to do this kind of work. And I think particularly why the multicultural ed course is so effective is because you have a professor and you have graduate students and people who he brings in who have an understanding of a philosophy as well as an attitude, and that is carried out in the courses that they do. And so that brings me to our particular subject, which is the faculty self-study within the Curry School on teaching and learning. One thing about this project, I'll say it's been very organic. It started in September of 2007, if I were to put a date on it, but actually it even precedes my coming to UVA, where, Bob, how long has the Faculty Diversity Committee been meeting? Since 2000?
A long time.
And clearly sensing the need that there needed to be a move forward toward diversity in many different levels. About 2 years ago, we decided to tackle more empirically. When we talk about diversity, what are we talking about? What do we mean? What does it mean? What does it look like? What does it sound like? And we came to the conclusion that while we can look at students, we can talk about recruitment, that ultimately it was the faculty who sat around the table that determined whether diversity to a large extent could happen with any particular environment. And I was delighted to hear Lee Shulman say this morning the importance of self-study. Anyone who heard his wonderful talk this morning talked about how we as educators, in particular in Curry, are very much always talking about what's happening in K-12 and higher ed, but we don't necessarily look at ourselves. So this was a very bold attempt by my colleagues to begin to look at ourselves to say, what are we really doing? How are we doing it? If diversity in terms of teaching and learning is taking place within our building, what does it look like? What does it sound like? And if it doesn't, then what are the things that we need to do to make that happen? So although my name is listed and Dorothy Bach from the Teaching Resource Center is there, I kind of feel like the person on the Verizon commercial where the one person standing there but all these people are behind me. So I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Curry Faculty Diversity Committee that has approximately 30 members. Within that, we had a subcommittee that worked on this particular project, as well as the participants who agreed to be a part of the study. But I also must mention our students. Rob Izzo is going to join me on the panel for the question and answer session. He's been a student representative who's been very involved in that work, as well as Lynn Kratz, who's been involved with Seeds for Change, which is a student-driven group. Conceptually, just to very quickly frame it, we all know not only are K-12 classrooms changing, but kindergarten through undergraduate schools are changing because our country is just so complex and multifaceted. And we had an excellent example from the medical school in terms of how they're recognizing that change and making those classes more diverse. But by the same token, the kind of skills that we need and proficiencies to teach those students can't necessarily be the same things that we've done over 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 years, because we're dealing with very different groups of people and their needs are very distinct. And so it's very important that as faculty that we believe that in terms of being effective, that your teaching and learning has to not only reflect the content and the curriculum, but it's also got to reflect who you're teaching in class. And I won't go into various definitions of diversity, but I think another thing we realize too is that when we use the word diversity, it is very contextual. The definitions can vary depending upon the particular group, but in this particular case, we're thinking about considering race, ethnicity, culture, language, and religion in lesson design and implementation. So, as a result of the Curry Faculty Diversity Committee, input from colleagues, and so on, the first thing we had to do was decide or delimit what are we not going to cover. So we decided we were not going to look at curriculum because with such a diversity of courses, content, majors, and programs within Curry, to try to do that for every person would almost be impossible. We also decided that we weren't going to look at students because much of the research on students there was a lot of research on students, and again, we felt that people were doing that kind of work. So we found an area where we could make a contribution was ourselves. You know, I can't change the students who come to me. I may not be able to change the factors of the environment, but how can I, as a faculty person, think about what I do and how I do to be able to impact that? So that was the nature of our first question. What are the needs of the faculty as related to issues of diversity and cultural competence? And I really have to give it to our group because when we finally hammered this question out around the table, I think Bob remembers the moment. We all looked at one another and we said, is this where we really want to go? And we all took a deep breath and we said, yeah, we're going to go there. And then as a result of that, then the second question would then be, in what ways did faculty members' self-perceptions change? And what could we do to impact that? And so the key to this clearly is professional development. We sensed that it was something that was important, but we wanted to be able to empirically define what we might need to do in that area. So, given that, then, we created a qualitative case study design, because again, at this moment in time, we weren't as much specifically interested in the broader scheme, but we really felt that we needed to really examine individually faculty persons' backgrounds and what they were doing. And our information came from a variety of sources. Prior to actually starting the study with the COFU funding in January, we realized people had been doing this sort of work in a very informal way, or they had been doing it formally, but it had not been connected. And again, it reminded me of what Lee Shulman said this morning when he said, as scholars, our work means nothing if we don't share. And that we have a responsibility to be able to engage with other people in that work. And he provided a beautiful quote when he said, when we cite people, when we footnote people, he said, those are the thank you notes that we give people in our profession for the work that they're doing. And so you're either building on other people's work or you're setting work so that other people can build on yours. So we found that the Faculty Diversity Committee prior to 2010 had done many of these things. They had looked at informal curriculum audits through faculty syllabi in terms of actually looking at how are faculty defining diversity and what are the components that they have in their courses. Then we were also very fortunate to get student feedback. There was a graduate school doctoral class that took it upon itself as a project to do a survey and to find out from other students how they perceive diversity to be in their courses from their professors with their specific engagement. And with it, many, many more courses could be like multicultural education, which, by the way, is one of the most popular courses in Curry. They're modest in the sense that consistently there's a wait list for the class. There are multiple sections for the class that are offered. And even outside of Curry, there are students around Brown's who know that this course has been effective for many people. And then the third thing, in addition to feedback from students in general, was this particular report that the graduate students compiled. So at least we had some things to start from. And I think it's also significant that you see, for the most part, other than looking at faculty syllabi, which we collected, much of the impetus for this within this school came from students. Students say that we want to see how we can do our courses differently. So as a result of that, then, we applied for a Commission on the Future of University grant, which we received, and with that grant, then, we were able to provide some graduate research assistance and begin to look for some of the resources that we needed to do the work. So from January to July of last year, we literally perused the literature, had meetings about how we wanted to design the study, what we wanted to do, and how we wanted to do it, and then from August to December, we actually collected the data. And of the 110 Curry faculty members who potentially could have participated, we sorted through and decided that we had a potential pool of about 65 people. Because we specifically took out tenure track faculty, and there were a couple other criteria that we used to try to get faculty who we thought would represent the breadth of the school and be willing to work with us. And so from that particular group, we had six people who said, we'll do it and we'll go along with what you're doing. So from those six actual participants that we collected the data from, we then had a focus group in September, a smaller focus group in December. The faculty members agreed to be interviewed We did a teaching observation. We collected documents from their class to see what they were doing, how they were doing it. At this point in time, we realized we had a project that was much bigger than we could contain for all the other things we were doing. And that's when the folks at the Teaching Resource Center, they stepped in, we talked to one another, and it's been an incredible collaboration that's just beginning that we hope will continue. So for the sake of time, I'm just going to go through the key themes that we found, specifically from the faculty data, but understanding that many of these other things, too, will be playing into our final report. Number one, we clearly saw among faculty how they define diversity varied. So it's really important when we talk about diversity to identify what are we talking about and in what ways. Secondly, that their teaching approaches clearly reflected their own particular pedagogical beliefs and paradigms. And so a one-size-fits-all in terms of how we sensitize faculty, how faculty delve deeper, not only in teaching about diversity or for diversity, but how are the ways in which you structure your class that create the environment to allow for the exchange of ideas and diverse viewpoints and perspectives. The third one, which I think we found significant and the one we're going to be looking at tackling, is classroom climate and how classroom climate can very much affect the degree to which your curriculum and content and other things can occur. And this was probably the one area where we isolated where as a faculty and as a university, we could be most helpful in faculty professional development. That people are going to have their content, they're going to have their own unique individual personality and ways, but how can we impact classroom climate? And then the fourth thing that we just had to be honest about was to say that within the current structure of the way in which we're designed, while there are many things that Curry is doing that are dynamic and we're moving in different directions, that we don't have structured avenues to have the engagement, not only in the conversations, but in providing the professional development to do the work that needs to be done. So in terms of what our next steps will be, because this is still a work in progress, we decided in order to try to have an immediate impact, we invited Dr. Catherine Plank from The Ohio State University. And in conjunction with the Teaching Resource Center, we conducted a workshop in January that was called Diversity in the Classroom. We made it available to the entire faculty student body because we felt that it really was more than what Curry should keep to itself. And from that particular workshop that we did in January, we had 78 participants from many schools throughout the university. The workshop rating in terms of the material that she provided, the activities and so on, was a 4.31 from the 1 to 5 range. And with those 78 participants, it's estimated that they will impact over 3,000 students that they would be teaching this semester. That was a great way to test the waters to see what we would need to do. She also did some individual consulting with us specifically to help us begin to shape what that would look like within our school, understanding that it can't look the same in every one of those schools because of the climate. So literally where we are right now, we're working on our collaboration on how we can more institutionalize and structure what we're doing, looking at how we can maximize professional development opportunities with faculty when we know that time at retreats and at various points in the year is very precious. But in all fairness, we've got some challenges because diversity seems to be a particular topic that it can gain a momentum, but how do we sustain it? And then more important, I think the medical school's done a very good example of how it is an institutional and structural and systemic commitment that must be there in order for these things to have the kind of sustainability that we want. So we are still a work in progress. I must stay tuned, but we're very excited in finally being able to move this forward from being what people very often like to call a messy construct to something that is clearly empirical and far-reaching. Thank you.
Thanks again to all of our presenters. And we have until 12:30 for question and answer, and then I know people are ready to get off to the Aquatic and Fitness Center for lunch. So that leaves us about 25 minutes for questions and answers. Question and answer. So anyone want to start off?
Thank all of you first. I've in this short time, I've been enlightened, so I appreciate the presentation. I'm Dr. When you were looking, when you were looking at the students through the binoculars, probably the large, that 35% that said they had changed. Well, before that question, what's the gender makeup for your class about? Would you say?
I say it's about 60 to 65% women.
Okay. And does the 35 imagine the change? Were they primarily, did you have any sense of what?
Do you want to be amazed by percentages?
Yes.
Okay. 58% of the males who were white said they changed more than their female counterparts.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Nice guy. Yes. Along that study in longitudinal, is there any way, what is the maintenance of that cultural, that cultural experience? So beyond that class and that year, is there something that's done? Can you tell me about 2 years later, people still feeling they're growing, or that they're meeting new people, and you're still getting that wonderful feeling you said when you see people interact and meet new people, and how that growth is happening? So is that still happening?
Well, I mean, I could address that only in the sense of people that I see who have been in the class or who will contact me afterwards. I mean, I don't include the ones who are asking for a recommendation. Cause that's but, I mean, yeah, you hear people say that this has been a valuable experience. So, I mean, we have done, there was one study done about 5 years ago where they followed up with students who had been in the class. It turned out, you know, the structure of the class is that people go through the class, and then those who are interested come back, and we teach them how to run small groups. And that study, ended up being mostly for small groups. Selena Cozart did that study, and so there's some evidence there that they were still thinking about it. So,
this is anecdotal evidence because I have some graduate students now in the counseling program who took Bob's course, and one was a facilitator. And they report that what we teach, which is very specific about counseling, not just the whole, they have to grow as multicultural beings, but they have to then adapt as clinicians to a therapeutic approach for diversity. And they say that was a very facilitative, that when they came in, they had half of the work done that they see their colleagues now having to do.
Yeah. And if I might add, particularly because this is Curry, I mean, this is an area that the faculty committee is looking at and saying, how can we grow and build from this? That this is a course that clearly has had change for students. But quite frankly, if you look at our courses within the School of Education, we don't have many courses proportionally that specifically address diversity in this way. Likewise, that doesn't mean that people aren't teaching about these issues in their classes. But I think the research is now showing us that for diversity to be effective in teaching and learning, it has to be both. That it has to be done within a particular professor's course, but it also must be targeted and specifically defined. Rob and I encountered one another because I did a doctoral level seminar 2 years ago that was on research and diversity in teaching and learning, which was the first time a course like that had been offered within Curry. And so not only is it giving students experiences, but it's also creating that academic pipeline for master's and doctoral level courses so that students can study this in a rigorous way, particularly within the School of Education, whatever their particular discipline is. So I think this is Rob Izzo, who was in the course and very active. I'm going to let you pop in because I think what he has to say is really important in terms of how that particular course fed into your dissertation work and so on.
Absolutely. In Professor Grimes' class, we had an opportunity to study a lot of the same topics that I believe are discussed in Bob Covert's course. And focus on ways of bringing that into the research so you're able to study multicultural issues in a systematic and methodologically rigorous way. And by getting doctoral students to focus on this, then perhaps you can impact a larger group of people through research and getting other doctoral students involved and getting the ball rolling and hopefully having a snowball effect.
I would just like to say that I taught high school for a long time and then I took Bob's class. And then I quit my job to come up here and work with Bob. So I think it has long-term consequences.
That's a big endorsement.
That's a pretty big endorsement. It was like being a...
I have a question for the School of Medicine. I know that recently UVA and I think the University of Pennsylvania have eliminated concrete, like certain prerequisites that you have to take, and now students are just expected to demonstrate competency through the MCAT exam. So how do you think that will influence the number of underrepresented minorities going to medical school?
That's an excellent question. I think, as you said, We have, as of this year, we no longer have any requirements. We no longer have biology, physics, organic chemistry, or chemistry. We recommend cell biology, behavioral medicine, and statistics, as well as biochemistry. But I think the idea is that it's going to allow people to, who maybe would have hesitated to apply, to sort of stretch themselves a little bit to come to us and to allow themselves to kind of come in. We realize that medicine is just a very different thing than it used to be, and interactive, collaborative relationships is sort of in some ways more primary than anything else.
One of the things I would add to that would be it's only going to become effective if it gets publicized. I think one of the Sullivan Commission's recommendations mentioned the sort of difference in academic advising that can sometimes happen with the pre-med students. So it's one of those things that we need to make sure that the people who are applying know that, and then are aware of those requirements and the changes, because a lot of them are not. And one of the initiatives that we have taken on is to actually go out there, go and recruit, mention that these are the aspects of our school that are different and new that you may not have known about, that your pre-med advisor may not be aware of. So I think it will be really effective in changing the composition of the applicant pool, but only if we can get it out there and let them know that, that's what we're doing.
And I think actually more importantly, the fact that we are a pass-fail system has had a huge impact, because people can really help each other, bring each other up. The competition is not an unhealthy competition, and I think actually that is one of the big features that's allowing us to recruit people who, you know, might be a little shy otherwise.
Thanks for all the presentations. I have a question probably directed mostly to the folks in the School of Medicine. I think that the academic system anywhere is very good at replicating itself, and that means through admissions processes as well as the faculty that you choose to hire and tenure, and which is one of the things that makes the changes this sort of so difficult. So a sort of two-part question. One is, and I'm from the School of Architecture, which I would say is a culture is more like medicine than education. My sense of education from other institutions go into education are predisposed to be interested in diverse cultures, perhaps more than allegedly or apparently objective criteria that might be used to select a student in medicine, and similarly in architecture. We have blind portfolio reviews. So the question is, how did you change the criteria of admission to be more holistic or comprehensive, I think? And then what was the impact of having students on the committee? Were they voting members? Did they feel empowered to make tough calls and argue cases? Because I think that's what it's
saying. I got your second question first. I was on the admissions committee, and I had the same vote as any faculty member. We got into arguments. We kind of fought for our person that we liked. But I felt totally comfortable with the admissions committee and stating my opinions on applicants, whether I like them or not so much.
And are you allowed in the admissions process to identify diversity?
Yes.
So we have two places where we do that. One of the things is actually applicants self-identify, so they define themselves however they choose to for AMCAS. We also have a disadvantaged tab, and we ask them to write about that if they consider themselves to be disadvantaged and why. When we say holistic, I mean we go through 4,300 applications with a fine-tooth comb. We really, really look very carefully at where people are coming from. We also think of Southwest Virginia, for example, as an underrepresented area. About 50% of our students come from Virginia, and 50% of our students come from outside Virginia. So we really try to figure out where people are coming from, and then we really try and look at their life experiences. We find the personal essay is very important, the letters of recommendation very important. And of course, you know, we do look at the GPA and MCAT because we do have a screening process. But we, as Dr. Moxley says, we aggressively go out and we recruit. We really encourage people to come to us, ask us questions, give us their concerns, and then help them kind of get to the next step. For us, one of the most important things is actually shadowing, to know that people know what they're getting into. We ask them to walk in the footsteps of a physician, and that is one of the meaningful things. And then, of course, we want to see humanism, empathy as manifested by volunteerism, community service. We love it when people have been teaching or tutoring or sort of giving something of themselves. We weigh that very heavily as well.
And for me as an interviewer, I assume that they've gotten an interview here, their grades and MCATs are fine. So I really don't pay attention to it. And then I just focus on the interview and what they've done in their community and during their undergraduate courses.
Have you all increased your team?
The
admission staff and what
are yes, actually, it has actually increased. I would say it's increased from 2 or 3 to 5 or 6 at this point. Which has made a difference. The other thing I wanted to say is that there's a push to have MCATs and GPAs be blinded for the people who interview, so that we, and that's something that we're discussing, because we really want it to be an interview with an we want the interpersonal stuff to be the primary issue, and we don't want there to be any sort of accidental selection bias.
I just want to piggyback on that. I think that's a great idea. Kudos to you all for doing that, because earlier in the presentation, I appreciate you saying that you all look at things much more holistically and not only at the MCAT scores. But sometimes in an audience of, you know, in discussions like this, people say, well, then, of course, the minority or underrepresented people are going to have lower scores. And that's not necessarily the case. So it's important that I think you bring out that you don't even, like the student representative on the admissions committee, I don't even look at that because I know they're going to make that. You know, I know those are going to be okay. So yeah, they are at the same standards, because I get a lot of people saying, well, you know, no, we're not talking about affirmative action here. We're talking about, well, they're not, you know, held up to the same standards as I am. Their MCAT scores can be this. But you don't know. The person next to you there is might have been much lower too, regardless of how they look, you know. So you just, I think that's really important. So that people know that, you know, to get into a program, they still have to have a baseline standard. And there is, you know, there is the contextual things that you're looking at, but everybody is, you know, at that point brought to the same level.
If I can also add, in the other role that I currently serve as the Interim Associate Dean in the Office of African American Affairs, there's a process that I've been involved with this semester, and it's the Health Advisory Board interview, and I don't want that to be left out. That any University of Virginia student who is applying to medical school has the opportunity to have their packet go through career services, and in addition to getting the support for that package to be as comprehensive as possible, there's a set of independent interviews that are done, and I've done about 24 of them this year, where I'm writing letters of recommendation for students, specifically as someone who is not a part of that medical process. And while I do have access to their portfolio, which gives me their general information, I literally sit for an hour with each student and talk, and then the letters that there's approximately 12 of us from throughout the university who are doing this with students, and it gives us an opportunity to ask that student questions, for them to highlight things about their particular portfolio that may not be evident in scores and so on. And I think it's something that I've never heard of any other university doing in that realm, to help our students prepare to be competitive for medical schools in other places throughout the country. And although it is labor intensive, it does give someone an opportunity to holistically look at our applicants, and then that letter of recommendation is a part of the other materials that then go out. And so I think that's something very unique as well. We think about what the admissions committee does, but I think it's important to highlight that this is a step that they're taking on the other side for any student to try to help make that portfolio as solid as possible.
Frank?
I'm going to offer what I think is a challenging and sensitive question, but first, just to acknowledge one of my takeaways is, if you can get a group of committed people together to think thoughtfully and strategically about changing something they want to change and evaluate it, actually be successful, you all have done that. The question I have to do, that I have, is actually, what is the reason why you're doing this? And I can see that there are funders who may be requiring, you need to demonstrate that you've got a more diverse medical school.
Go ahead.
But also, if you're going to do all specifically, you don't have to go very far to see the racial disparities in medical care and health outcomes just outside of medical school or in the classrooms, K-12 classrooms as well. And so, is that, I'm prompting you, is that one of the reasons why you're doing this, or is it not? And, but if it is, in other words, if you're really looking at, we want to impact outcomes outside of the classroom in certain ways, would you measure that?
Yeah, I think there are a number of motivations for this shift, if you will. I mean, I think a lot of it is, speaking individually, people do want to give back. People do want to make sure that the healthcare disparities are eliminated. And we get a lot of that from people who have even applied for medical school class. So I certainly think that's one motivation. I also have noticed that governing bodies like the AAMC will come through and they will say, we're looking at the composition of your class and it's not diverse enough. You must make efforts to increase diversity. So I think some of it's coming from external bodies, a lot of it is coming from individual, just we want to do the right thing. And people are saying, yeah, of course, diversity is the marker of institutional excellence. So if you want to be up there, really in the excellent universities, excellent teaching institutions, you got to be more diverse. So that's my field, my take on what the motivations are.
For me, it's a little bit different. I've been doing this for 35 years now, and that which is personal became professional. As a graduate student back in the late 60s, early 70s, I would look around my class, and I was the only one. So frequently, I was the exhibit, show and tell, target, whatever it was. And I saw a lot of things that were very ignorant, and I figured, how do we do this? And slowly, other students who were minority got together and we said, how do we educate these people? We meant these people, our faculty and our fellow students. And there was very little literature, so thank God for cultural anthropologists who helped us find our way and begin looking at this systematically. And what is interesting is, to this day, there's not a diversity course in my transcript. They did not exist when I was coming up. And I find myself teaching and telling students, I'm teaching you something that I learned by experience and had to really scour the literature to get it. Nowadays, it's wonderful how much information is out there. People read it, but they still don't do it. So my commitment is not only how can I impress upon you the urgency of this, which is, I do counseling. We train school counselors. So how do I conscientize, the way Paulo Freire would say it, these individuals to know that each and every one of us are responsible for this? Because 20 years ago, my dream was we never will have to teach this again. It will be part of the fiber of education. And it's not happening. In cycles, people say, we've done it, that's we're done. And that's not true. Ratios, percentages, is not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for every citizen to be conscientious enough and aware enough of themselves as a cultural being and how they transmit knowledge. So now I've taken the hardcore, I'm going to measure outcomes. There's a lot of people teaching it. I want to know, what do students tell me they learn about themselves as a cultural being, and then as a transmitter of culture, because that's what education is. It's an acculturation of people. And so how are we acculturating this generation? Are we really, really teaching them to get along in the world, which is getting smaller? Or are we just teaching them content that they can regurgitate and do something with? So it's for me, it's a commitment to the future, to having people who are culturally literate in the best essence of the word, not just information. And that takes a lot of stretching. And the students say it hurts. But then they say it was a good hurt.
I would say my first response was, I have grandchildren. But then I thought that was a bit flippant. I mean, about 25 years ago, we went to the provost. I'm a recovering statistician. And 25 years ago, we went to the provost and said, we need to do diversity training here. This was about 15 years after African Americans and women were admitted. Systematically, there were serious problems at the university. The provost said, we will give you $20,000. I mean, his response was, well, how do you know you need diversity training? I mean, it's like, duh, we know what we need. But, you know, but he said, how do you know? So he gave us $20,000 to do a survey of faculty, graduate students, and administration. We did a year-long census survey. We ended up with like close to 4,000 responses, came back, and of that, about two-thirds of the people said yes, they wanted the training. And his response was, we don't have any money for that. And at that point, it occurred to me that I was, and at the time I was doing a lot of evaluation work, and it just occurred to me, we knew the answer before we started. We got the answer that we knew, and then I was just a part of the problem. So that's when we parlayed that money into, or that we parlayed the information from that into getting a grant from the Strait Council, and we developed this model for doing diversity teaching in the class and training. And the thing that I would say is, at the time, it was always obvious that people of color and women were not being treated fairly, but there were a lot of white guys that weren't being treated all that great either. I mean, it's one of the things that's really fascinating to me about this. As you take this on systematically, you improve the atmosphere for everybody. And I think that, you know, that, so that's, you know.
And my focus is K-12 students. I'm hoping to work with student teachers because the teachers in the public schools are the ones that are going to be on the ground level dealing with this diversity. And they.
I have a question about the Curry self-study for Patrice. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in this this issue of whether or not you found anything from your study that looked at the relative significance of diversity-oriented content compared to sort of diversity in the pedagogical or methodological approach. And whether or not, I'm imagining it's possible for someone to actually do diversity in a very non-diverse way, and vice versa. So I'm sort of wondering whether that theme emerged at all, or whether from the people that you were working with in the study, there was more of a focus on integrating sort of diverse topical content issues into their courses, or whether there was a greater emphasis on sort of those classroom climate issues and the sort of more pedagogical sorts of elements that might influence diversity.
I have to say, with the six participants who were chosen, I'd have to say both. Because since the content in our school is so broad, at one time we had 26 different programs. We have people who are very quantitative in their approaches, people who are very qualitative, and so on. For some people, and again, it was one classroom observation, one interview with that particular teacher, and then looking at documents. And the teacher, the professor had the opportunity to choose whatever class he or she wanted us to come to. So we didn't make any, you know, restrictions on this is what we want to see when we come or what you're going to do. I say, you know, three of the six teachers chose specifically to highlight lessons where issues of diversity, culture, and so on were of the content of the class for that particular period. But there were others who did not do that, who specifically taught their particular subject content, but there were ways pedagogically in which they asked questions and framed things in such a way to create an open classroom climate, to be inclusive, and so on. And so I think that goes back to one of the themes, that one of the first things we've identified is there's no rubber stamp for diversity, and that whenever we use the word defining, how do we mean it in this way? What are the groups in which we mean? And there may end up being a dual or triplicate track of, if you're looking at infusing diversity in your teaching, there may be pedagogical ways in which you can do it, and Banks has outlined that in terms of steps, and Carl Grant and Christine Sleater have done that. We also may be looking at content, which is what I think we got into our doctoral level seminar. What are the ways in which we frame our thinking as scholars in looking at material? So, I mean, I'll never forget in grad school when we did Kuhn Scientific Revolutions. You know, there's nothing about diversity in his material, but we looked at that in a very, very socio-cultural, historical way to deconstruct. So it's helping scholars create the lenses that they need to look through as well. So that's kind of another track. So I think in some ways we realize it's much more complex than we thought it was, but at least I think it's going to help us identify to get started with this, what's the way in which we can do it to kind of at least initially get people going. So that goes back to the professional development and tying in the Teaching Resource Center and piggybacking on the awesome job that they do in terms of helping teachers develop their own professional, and professors, their professional competence. So whether it's through the Course Design Institute, whether it's through other offerings that they provide. And again, it's wonderful to have a group of people who have that sort of sensitivity. And I mean, Michael Palmer is an excellent example of someone who teaches chemistry. And the way in which he teaches is a way in which is very inclusive and very sensitive to that. So it's going to take quite a few things, but I think we're on the road to figuring out how we can diagnose, quote unquote, to help people get the support they need to be more competent.
Okay. Well, we're at 12:30, and I think that some surveys are going around, and they're going to be at the end of each session, and there will be directions for you to meet the bus to go to the Aquatic and Fitness Center for lunch, and you could stick around and talk to our panelists. I'd like to thank everyone for a wonderful session.